Chapter 15. The Cave of Hypnos. White Naga, Angel of Fire. A new land raider had been found for the War Master, equipped with a flare shield, layered plates of bonded ceramite with ablative ion disruptors, shroud dispensers and frag launchers. The Mechanicum had repeated their claim that it was proof against all but the weapons of a battle engine. Horus let Ezekiel kill 16 of them to remind them of the last time they had made that boast. The land raider idled in the foothills of a mountain chain known as the Unter Messas. Thousands of armored vehicles surrounded it, connected together in lagers to form miniature fortresses. The Lord of Iron himself would have approved of the defenses arranged around the War Master. An unbroken chain of supply vehicles, tankers, ammo carriers, and Mechanicum loaders stretched back to the coast. Warhounds prowled the line of supply like watchful shepherds, and two warlords in the colors of Legio Volcanum stood sentinel over the War Master. Horus climbed into the hills with the Mournival arranged around him in a tight circle. Farther out, terminators of the Justerian slogged uphill, looking more like relentless machines than living beings encased in armor. Ger Garadon's Lupakai were out there too, unseen in the darkness. Horus could feel their presence like a scratch on the roof of his mouth, invisible but impossible to ignore. A sky the color of disturbed sediment swirled overhead, and smoke curled from wrecked orbital batteries and missile silos on the mountaintops. Lightning split the night, a sky-wide sheet that silhouetted the jagged teeth of the mountain. Rain fell in a deluge. 100 new waterfalls spilled from the cliffs. Horus knew grander peaks than these, but viewed from this perspective, it seemed like they were the tallest he had ever seen. It looked like they might snag the moon at its passing. Fire raptors and thunderhawks flew overhead through static-charged clouds. Their engines were distant burrs over thunder that sounded like artillery. Energy discharges from the fighting in low orbit had wreaked havoc in the planet's atmospherics. A cascade effect of violent tempests was spreading all over Molech. Horus knew those storms were only going to get worse until a final apocalyptic event cleared the last of them. "It's madness to stop like this," said Abaddon, his armor streaked with rainwater and moonlight. "We're too exposed. First the gunships on Dwell, and then those knights. It's almost like you're trying to put yourself in harm's way. It's our job to take those kinds of risks." "You've known me long enough to know I am not cut from that kind of cloth, Ezekiel," said Horus. "I am a warrior. I cannot always sit back and let others shed blood for me."
"You're too valuable," pressed Abaddon.
"We have been down this road before, my son," said Horus, letting all four of them understand that this was his final word on the subject. Abaddon let the matter go, but like a hunting hound with a scent of blood in its nostrils, Horus knew he'd be back to that particular argument before long. "Very well, but every moment we delay, the deeper the bastards can dig in," said Abaddon.
"You still believe this world matters?"
asked Noctua, as breathless as a mortal. Horus paused and listened to Grail's heartbeat through the rain. His secondary heart was still catching up to the level of his original, and his circulation likely wouldn't ever be as efficient as his supra-engineered biology required.
"What do you mean, matters?" said Abaddon. "I mean as a military objective, something to be won in battle, then held and consolidated."
"Of course," said Abaddon. "Molech is a stepping stone world. We control it and we control the elliptical way. Easy access to Segmentum Solar's warp routes and the Bastion's worlds of the outer systems. It's a precursor world to the assault on Terra."
"You're wrong, Ezekiel," said Aximand. "This invasion has never been about anything as prosaic as territory. As soon as we win this fight, we'll abandon Molech, won't we, my lord?"
"Yes, little Horus," said the War Master. "Most likely we will. If I'm right about what the Emperor found on Molech, then it won't matter what worlds we hold. All that's going to be important is what happens when I face my father. That's always been at the heart of this."
"So why are we fighting, as if we give a damn about Molech?" asked Kyber. "Why wage a ground war at all?"
"Because what we will take away will be worth more than 100 such rocks," said Horus. "You have to trust me on this." "Do you trust me, Falcus?"
"Of course, sir."
"Good. Then no more questions," said Horus.
We should reach the cave soon.
What cave? Said Aximand.
The cave where the Emperor made us forget, Molek.
The woman's hard-wearing fatigues suggested a port worker, maybe a rigger, hard to be sure with the amount of blood covering them. Her chest rose and fell in stuttering hikes, every breath a victory. She'd been brought to Noama Calva's Gallinus by a weeping man with two children in tow. He'd begged Noama to save her, and they were going to give it a damn good try.
What happened to her? Asked Noama, cutting the woman's bloodied clothes away.
The man didn't answer at first. Sobs racked his body and tears flowed down his open, earnest face. The two girls were doing a better job of holding it together.
I can do more for her if I know what happened, said Noama. Tell me your name. You can do that, can't you?
The man nodded, and he wiped his snot and tear-streaked face with his sleeve, like a child.
Jeff, he said. Jeff Parsons.
And where are you from, Jeff? Said Noama. The woman moaned as Kajel began cleaning her skin and attaching bio-readout pads. She tried to push him off, strong for someone so badly hurt.
Easy there, said Kajel, pressing her arm back down.
Jeff? Asked Noama again. Keep your eyes on me.
He was looking at the brutalized flesh of his wife's body, seeing the blood dripping from the gurney. The woman reached up and took his hand in hers, leaving red marks on his wrist.
She was a strong one, saw Noama, badly hurt but still able to offer comfort to those around her.
Jeff took a deep breath.
Her name's Olivia, but she hates that, thinks it sounds too formal. We all call her Liv, and we came from Larsa.
The Sons of Horus had landed in force at Larsa, wiping out the army forces stationed there in one brutal night of fighting. The port facilities were now in enemy hands, which could only be a bad thing.
But you got her and your children out, said Noama. That's good. You did better than most.
No, said Jeff. That was all Liv. She's the strong one.
Noama had already come to that conclusion. Olivia had the lean, wolfish look of a soldier, but she wasn't army. She had a faded tattoo on her right arm, a triangle enclosed in a circle with an eye at its centre. Blood covered the words written around the circle's circumference, but even if it hadn't, they were in a language Noama didn't recognise. She'd caught shrapnel in the side, some glass in the face. Nothing that looked life-threatening, but she was losing a lot of blood from one particular wound, just under her ribs. The readouts on the slate didn't paint a reassuring picture of her prognosis.
"We joined a column of refugees at the Ambrosius Radial," said Jeff, the words pouring from him now the dam inside had broken. "She thought she'd got out of Larsa quick enough, but the traitors caught up to us. Tanks, I think. I don't know what kind. They shelled us and shot us. Why did they do that? We're not soldiers, just people. We had children. Why did they shoot at us?"
Jeff shook his head, unable to comprehend how anyone could open fire on civilians. Noama knew just how he felt.
"She almost did it," said Jeff, his head in his hands. "She almost got us out, but there was an explosion right next to us. Blew off her door and... thrown, you can see what it did to her."
Noama nodded, digging around in the wound below Olivia's ribs. She felt something serrated buried next to her heart. A fragment of shrapnel. A big one. The volume of blood coming from the wound meant it had probably sliced open her left ventricle. With a proper Medicaid bay, it would be simple procedure to save Olivia. But a Gallinus wasn't the place for such complex surgery. She looked up at Kajel. He'd seen the bio readouts and knew what she knew. He raised an eyebrow.
I have to try, she said in answer to his unvoiced question. The import of the words went over Jeff's head, and he kept speaking. They killed everyone else. But Liv drove that Cargo 5 like it was an aeronautica fighter. Threw us all around the cab with tight turns, hard brakes and the like.
She drove you out of an attack by enemy tanks, said Kajel, making his impressed face as he sorted out the instruments they'd need to cut Olivia open and get to her heart. That's a hell of a woman.
Just about blew the engine out, agreed Jeff. But I guess that's why she wanted a 5. They're not max-rated riggers, but their engines pack a punch.
Noama placed an anaesthesia mask over Olivia's mouth and nose, cranking up the delivery speed. The rate of blood loss meant they had to be quick.
"You got your children out," she said. "You saved them."
Olivia's eyes opened, and Noama saw desperation there.
"Please,
The book, it says, have to get to Lupercalia,
she gasped into the mask.
Promise me you'll get us there.
Olivia took Noama's hand and squeezed. The grip was powerful, urgent. Conviction and courage flowed from it, and the need to make Olivia's last wish a reality was suddenly all that mattered to Noama. It only relaxed when the gas began to take effect.
I'll get you there, she promised, and knew she meant it more than she'd meant anything in her life. I'll get you all there.
But Olivia didn't hear her promise. In the decades since Molek's compliance, something large and predatory had made its lair in the cave. Bones lay scattered by an entrance large enough for a scout titan, and not even the rain could cover the stench of partially digested remains. The earth at the cave mouth was a sopping quagmire, but blurred impressions of clawed feet wider than a dreadnought's, crossed and recrossed.
"What made thee, sir?" said Axamand, kneeling by the tracks. Horus had no answer for him. The tracks were from no beast he remembered from Molek, though given the fractured recall of his time on this world, that shouldn't have surprised him. And yet it did. The Emperor hadn't erased his memories, only manipulated them. Grayed some out, blurred others. He knew the indigenous beasts of Molek. He'd seen their heads mounted on the walls of the Nightholds, had studied their images and dissected corpses in illuminated bestiaries. So why did he not recognize these tracks?
Sir, repeated Axamand, what are we going to find in there?
Let's find out, said Horus, pushing aside his doubts and marching into the darkness.
The Justerian suit lamps swept the wide entrance, and the claws of Horus's talon shimmered with blue light as he followed them inside. Strobed shadows painted heavily scored walls. Abaddon went next, then Kyber, Axamand, and Noctua. The cave corkscrewed into the mountain for perhaps 100 meters, lousy with distorted echoes and strangely reflected light. As tall as a processional on a starship, the passage shimmered with rainwater seeping through microscopic cracks in the rock. The shifting beams caught falling droplets, and shimmering rainbows arced between the walls. They paused as the low, wet growl of something large and hungry was carried from deeper in the tunnels. Territorial threat noise.
Whatever that is, we should leave it alone, said Kyber.
For once I'm in total agreement with you, Falcus, said Noctua.
No, said Horus. We go on.
I knew you were going to say that, said Abaddon.
And if we run into whatever that is, said Axamand,
we kill it.
The Mournival drew closer to Horus, each with a bladed weapon and firearm drawn. Moisture drizzled the air. It pattered on armor plates and hissed on powdered blade edges.
You know what it is, don't you? Said Axamand.
No, said Horus. I don't.
The sounds of animal breath rasping over dripping fangs came again. It drew Horus on, even as some primal part of his brain told him that whatever lurked in the darkness beneath the mountain was something not even he could defeat. The thought was so alien that he stopped in his tracks. The intrusion to his psyche was so subtle that only a thought so incongruous to his self-image revealed its presence. It didn't feel like an attack, though, more an innate property of the cave, or a side effect of whatever had happened here. Horus pressed on, the passageway eventually widening into a rugged cavern thick with dripping stalactites and blade-like stalagmites. Some ran together in oddly conjoined columns, wet and glistening, like malformed bones or mutant sinews. A stagnant lake filled the centre of the cavern, its surface a basalt mirror. Rotted vegetation, festering dung, and heaps of bone taller than a man were heaped at the water's edge. The ambient temperature dropped by several degrees, and plumes of breath feathered before the War Master and his sons. Horus's skin tingled at the presence of something achingly familiar, yet wholly unknown. He'd felt something similar at the base of the lightning-struck tower, but this was different. Stronger, more intense, as though his father was standing just out of sight, hidden in the depths and watching. Shadows stretched and slithered as the beams of the Justerian's lamps swept around the chamber.
I have been here before, he said, removing his helmet and hooking it to his belt.
You remember this cavern? Said Axamand,
as the Mournival and Justerin spread out? No, but every fibre of my body tells me I stood here, said Horus, moving through the chamber. Light refracting through the translucent columns and crystalline growths imparted colour to the walls, bilious green, cancerous purple, bruise yellow. They were standing in the guts of the mountain, literally, a chamber of digestion. A soot light played over the lake, holding steady enough for Horus to picture it as a low-hanging moon. Not Molech's moon, but Terra's moon, as though the lake wasn't a body of water at all, but a window through time. He'd sat with his father on the shores of the Tuz Golu and skimmed rocks at the image of the moon, and for a moment, just a fleeting moment, he could smell its hypersaline waters. The light moved on, and the water was just water. Cold and hostile, but just water. With a growing sense of purpose, Horus made his way towards the water's edge. Shadows where no shadows ought to be stretched over the walls, and a thousand muttering voices seemed to rise from the water. He glanced back at the Mournival. Could they hear the voices or see the shadows? He doubted it. This cave was not entirely of this world, and whatever was keeping it anchored was fraying. Just by being here, he was tugging on its loose threads. The image of bones and sinews returned, something organic, the architecture of the mind. That's what you did here, he said, turning on the spot. You cut through the world here and reshaped us, made us forget what we'd seen you do.
Sir,
said Axemand. Horus nodded to himself. This is the scab you left behind, father. Something this powerful leaves a mark, and this is it. The bruise you left behind when you shaped your lie. The frayed edge pulled a little more. The scab peeled back. Ghost shapes moved through the cavern, given life by his picking at the wound in the angles of space and time. Each was numinous and smudged, like figures seen through dirty glass. They were indistinct, but Horus knew them all. He walked among them, smiling as though his brothers were here with him now. The Khan stood here, said Horus, as the first figure stopped and took a knee on his left. A second figure knelt to his right. The lion over there. Horus felt himself enveloped in light, cocooned by its cold illumination. He'd retraced the steps he'd taken almost a century ago without even knowing it. Horus moved back, detaching from a rendering of his own body in ambient light. Like his spectral Primarch brothers, his radiant doppelganger knelt as a figure approached from across the lake, gold fire and caged lightning. The Emperor, without his mask.
What is this?
Demanded Abaddon, his bolter raised and ready to fire. The figures were only now becoming visible to them. Horus waved their weapons down.
An imprint left over from days past, he said. A psychic figment of a shared consciousness.
The ghost of his father walked over the surface of the lake, wordlessly repeating whatever psychocognitive alchemy he had wrought to reshape the pathways in the minds of his sons.
This is where I forgot, Molech, said Horus. Maybe here is where I will remember it.
Axemand raised his bolter again, aiming it at the numinous being on the water.
You said that thing is an echo. A psychic imprint?
Yes, said Horus.
Then why is it boiling the lake?
The chirurgeon's metallic fingers trembled as they applied yet another fleshcraft to Raven's right arm. The skin from pectorals to wrist was pink and new like a newborn's. The pain was intense, but Raven now knew that physical suffering was the easiest pain to endure. Edoraki Hakon's death meant the task of keeping the thousands of soldiers who'd escaped Avedon alive had fallen to him. Legio Fortitas had won the retreating Imperial forces a chance to properly regroup in the wooded vales of the Agribelt. With luck and a fair wind, they should link with forward elements of Tyana Kurion's Grand Army of Molech outside Lupercalia, in 2 days. Coordinating a military retreat was hard enough, but Raven also had to deal with an ever-growing civilian component. Refugees were streaming in from the north and east, from Larsa, Ivithia, Leosta and Luthre, from every agri-collective, moisture farm and livestock commercia.
Born in an armada of ground cars, cargo carriers, and whatever motive transport could be found, tens of thousands of terrorized people had been drawn to Raven's ragamuffin host. He'd welcomed the burden, the role so consuming it kept him from dwelling on the loss of his sons. But with the threat of immediate destruction lifted, Raven's thoughts turned inwards. Tears flowed, and grief-fueled rages had seen a dozen aides beaten half to death. A hole had opened inside him, a void that he only now recognized had been filled by his sons. He'd never known joy to compare to Ajelic's birth, and Oscar's arrival had been no less wonderful. Even Cyprian cracked a smile, the old bastard finally pleased with something Raven had done. Banan had struggled to enter the world. Birth complications had almost killed him and his mother, but the boy had lived, though he had ever been a brooding presence in the feast halls. Hard to like, but with a rebellious streak Raven couldn't help but admire. Looking at Banan was like looking in a mirror. Only Oscar now remained, a boy who displayed no aptitude or appetite for knightly ways. Against his better judgment, Raven had allowed the boy to follow Lyx into the serpent cult. The chirurgeon finished his work, and Raven looked down at the crimson, oxygenated flesh of his arm. He nodded, dismissing the man who gratefully retreated from Raven's silver-skinned pavilion. Other chirurgeons had been less fortunate. Raven rose from the folding camp seat and poured a large goblet of Caban wine. His movements were stiff, the new flesh and reset bones of his chest still fragile. Banilash had been badly damaged, and the repercussions of the knight's hurt were borne by his body. He swallowed the wine in one gulp to dull the ache in his side. He poured another. The pain in his side dimmed, but he'd need a lot more to dull the pain in his heart.
"Is that wise?" said Lyx, sweeping into the tent.
She'd arrived from Lupercalia that morning, resplendent in a crimson gown with brass and mother-of-pearl panels.
"My sons are dead," snapped Raven, "and I'm going to have a drink. Lots of drink, in fact."
"These soldiers are looking to their Imperial commander for leadership," said Lyx. "How will it look if you tour the camp, stumbling around like a drunk?"
"Tour the camp?"
"These men and women need to see you," said Lyx, moving close and pushing the wine jug back to the table. "You need to show them that House Divine stands with them, so they will stand with you when it matters most."
"House Divine," grunted Raven. "There practically isn't a House Divine anymore. The bastard killed Ajelic and Banan, or didn't you hear me tell you that when you got here?"
"I heard you," said Lyx.
"Really? I just wanted to be sure," snapped Raven, turning and throwing his goblet across the pavilion. "Because for all it seemed to affect you, I might as well have been talking about a particularly good crap I'd had."
"Horus slew them himself."
"Don't say that name," roared Raven, wrapping a hand around Lyx's neck and squeezing. "I don't want to hear it."
Lyx fought against him, but he was too strong and too enraged with grief. Her face crumpled and turned a livid shade of purple as he squeezed the life out of her. He'd always thought of her as fundamentally ugly, even if her outward appearance suggested otherwise. She was broken inside, and the thought sent a spasm of loathing through him. He was just as broken as her. Perhaps they both deserved to die. Maybe so, but she'd go first.
"My sons were to be my immortality," he said, almost spitting in her face as he pushed her back against the pavilion wall. "My legacy was to be the honourable continuance of House Divine, but the bastard Warmaster has put pay to that dream. My son's armour rusts on Avedon's beach, and their bodies lie rotted and unclaimed. Food for scavenger birds."
He felt something sharp at his groin, and looked down to see a hooked naga fang pressed against his inner thigh.
"I'll slice your balls off," said Lyx,
pressing the needle-sharp point hard against his leg.
"I'll open your femoral artery from your crutch to your knee. You'll empty in 30 seconds.
Raven grinned and released her, stepping away from his sister-wife with a grunt of amusement. Colour returned to her face, and he was sure that the excitement he saw in her eyes was mirrored in his own.
"Cut my balls off and House Divine really is finished," he said.
"A figure of speech," said Lyx, massaging her bruised throat.
"Anyway, your womb will be as barren as the Tazkar steppe by now," said Raven as Lyx poured them both a drink.
He shook his head and took a goblet she offered him.
"We make a pair, don't we, dearest sister?
We are what our mother made us,
replied Lix. He nodded. So much for your talk of turning the tide.
Nothing has changed, said Lix, putting a hand out to stroke the pink flesh of his neck.
He flinched at her touch.
We still have Oscar, and he knows full well the importance of the continuance of the house name.
Shargily, she is more of a father to that boy, said Raven, only now understanding what a mistake it had been to allow him anywhere near the serpent cult. And from what I hear, he has no interest in taking just one consort, nor becoming father to a child. He won't be the one to keep the divine name alive.
He doesn't have to be a father, so long as he puts a child in the belly of a suitably pliant consort, said Lix. But that's a talk for when this war is concluded.
Raven nodded and accepted more wine. He felt a calming fuzziness at the edges of his perception. Wine and pain-balming chems were a heady mixture. He struggled to remember what they'd been talking about before their lover's tiff.
So, do you think I'm still the one whose actions will turn the tide of this war?
If anything, I'm even more certain of it,
said Lix.
Another vision?
Yes.
Tell me.
I saw Banalash in the heart of the great battle for Molech, in the shadow of Iron Fist Mountain. The tread of war gods shakes the earth. Flames surround the knights of Molech. Death and blood breaks upon Banalash in a red tide, and you fight like the Stormlord himself.
Lix's eyes misted over, cloudy with psychic cataracts.
A battle to end all battles rages around your knight, yet no blade, no shell, no enemy can lay it low. And when the appointed hour comes, the mightiest god on the field is slain. Its fall is a rallying cry, and all about scream the divine name.
The opaqueness of Lix's eyes faded, and she smiled as though a great revelation had just been revealed to her.
It's here,
she said, breathless with excitement. What is? Said Raven as the air turned chill.
The White Naga.
It's here? Now?
Lix nodded, turning around as though expecting to see the avatar of the serpent cult within Raven's pavilion.
The blood sacrifice made at Avedon has brought its divine presence into the realms of men,
she said, taking his hand.
The deaths of our sons has earned you the right to speak with it.
Where is it?
In the forest,
said Lix. Raven snorted at the vagueness of her reply. Can you be more specific? How do I find it? Lix shook her head.
Ride Banalash into the forest, and the White Naga will find you.
It moved faster than anything Horus had ever known, faster than an Eldar Blade Lord, faster than the Megarachnids of murder, faster than thought. Its body was mist and light, sound and fury. Adjusterin was the first to die, his body split down the middle as though he'd run full tilt into a bandsaw, his body emptied of blood and organs in a heartbeat. Horus moved before anyone else, slashing his taloned gauntlet at the glittering light. His claws cut empty air, and a golden fist slammed into his stomach. Doubled over, he saw Axeman shooting. The Widowmaker hunted for a target. Noctua was down on one knee, clutching his chest. Abaddon ran to his side, a long-bladed sword held low. Stuttering muzzle flare lit the cavern in strobing bursts. Suit lights swayed and danced. Hard volleys of mass reactive shattered crystalline growths, blew out fist-sized lumps of calcified stone. The Justerin moved to interpose themselves between their attacker and the Warmaster. Noctua fired from his knees. Kyber added his combi bolters to the sweeping barrage, not aiming, just firing. They hit nothing. The cavern was suddenly gloriously illuminated. An angel of fire, with swords of lightning held outstretched, faceless, remorseless, Horus recognized it for what it was. A sentinel creature, a final psychic trap emplaced by the Emperor to destroy those who sought to unpick the secrets of his past. Horus could barely fix on the beast. Its radiance was so fierce, so blinding. Its swords unleashed forking blasts of lightning, and Axemand was hurled across the cavern. His smoking body slammed into a wall, stone and armor split. Horus knew the impact trauma was enough to break his spine. Coruscating blue swords lashed out like whips. Abaddon dived to the side, his pauldron sheared clean away.
A portion of the first captain's shoulder remained inside, and bright blood sheeted his arm. One of the Justerin took a step towards his downed captain before remembering his place. The creature turned its gaze upon the Terminator. The warrior staggered. The combi bolter fell from his grip as he struggled to tear off his helmet. His screams over the vox were agonized. Liquid light writhed in the joints of his armor, spilling out in blistering streams of white-green fire. Horus shucked his taloned gauntlet, slamming shells into the breech of the inbuilt bolters. He often spoke of the murder harrow specs of Chthonia that led him to the weapon in an arming chamber of a long-dead warlord. That wasn't entirely accurate, but the truth was for Horus alone. The gauntlet's baroque craftsmanship was unmatched, and though Horus had been little more than a callow youth at the time, the gauntlet fitted his blood-scabbed hand as though fashioned just for him. A 2-meter tongue of flame blazed from the weapon. The recoil was savage, but Utsi Malevolus had built his armor well, and suspensor compensators kept it on target. Scads of light flew from the angel like molten steel. Torn from its body, its essence dimmed, dissolution turning it to vapor in seconds. It shrieked, and the air between it and Horus buckled with concussive force. The last Justerin flew apart, shattering like an assembly diagram of something vastly complex, his skeleton and internal biology atomized in a flash burn of intense light. Horus flew back, as though lifted by a hurricane. He came down hard in the water, its freezing temperature ramming the breath from him with an explosive fist. His mouth filled with black water. Throat muscles reacted instantly to seal his lungs and shift breathing to secondary respiratory organs. He spat black mouthfuls and rose from the water, in time to see Abaddon pinned in place by blazing tridents of lightning. Light poured from the first captain's mouth. Kyber's gunfire sprayed the Angel of Fire, surrounding it in swarms of phosphor embers. Enough mass-reactive shells to put down a Bulgrox achieved precisely nothing against the blazing sentinel. Horus marched from the lake, whips of fire arcing from his talon. Noctua plunged his sword into the angel's back. The blade melted in an instant, and Noctua cried in pain, clutching his ruined hand. Axemand crawled towards the fight, spine cracked, legs useless. Horus didn't bother to shoot the angel. He killed the power to his talons with a thought. Its essence was godly and mortal weapons were useless. He reached for his only other option. The angel spun to face him, releasing Abaddon from its crackling barbs. The first captain fell to his front, broiled near death by divine fire. The angel descended on Horus, wings of bright flame erupting from its back. The swords of lightning became elongated claws. Furnace heat blazed from its body. Horus stepped to meet it. He swung Worldbreaker in an upward arc, like a hammer thrower from an ancient age. A weapon forged by the Emperor's own hand, Worldbreaker was a gift from a god. Its killing head buried itself in the flaming body of the angel. Only one thing could end this creature, and that was the power that had birthed it. The angel exploded. Streamers of fire arced from its death like blazing promethium. It shrieked as the power binding it to this place was shattered. By the time the Warmaster's maul had completed its swing, the angel was no more. Its scream lingered long, echoing through the mountain, all across Molech and through uncounted angles of space and time. The embers of its sun-hot core drifted to the cavern floor like grave-bound fireflies. And with its death, Horus remembered Molech. He remembered everything.